This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. While Manchester City and Liverpool keep trucking along at the top, below them possibly the biggest result in the history of Brentford at their sanctioned rivals. Vitali Janelt's delightful dink, Christian Eriksen pulling the strings as Tony and Mbeumo dominated Tuchel's back line. Barring a sensational collapse, the Blues should still finish in the top four, but who will join them seems quite North London based as Manchester United drop yet more points at home while Spurs wake up to hammer Newcastle, putting the pressure on Arsenal, who play on Monday night. Also in the Premier League, Frank Lampard's excuses, James Ward-Prowse's free kicks and Calvin Phillips' shoes. And then there's the World Cup draw. Going by average world ranking, England have the toughest group. Don't laugh, Barry. Great to see people plotting our route to the final already. In Fitbar arrives Sarange. A win in the Old Firm means Celtic are firm favourites for the title. There's the Papa John's final excitement, some more pub graffiti, plenty of merchandise chat, a big announcement, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hiya, Max.
Hello, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Hello, Robin Cowan.
Hi, Max.
Right, let's start then at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea 1, Brentford 4. Lawrence says, after Iheanacho Gate and his Everton title prediction last year, I don't remember that one, may you allow Barry to have a moment to gloat for saying that Brentford would get a result against Chelsea?
I don't feel the need to gloat. I certainly didn't expect them to get that emphatic a result at Chelsea. It was a fantastic win. And it looked for a while like it might be a repeat of their defeat at the Brentford Community Stadium, where they hammered on the door for quite some time, then conceded a goal and lost. They did much the same here, except after conceding the goal, they didn't lose. They equalised very quickly and then won with a great performance, great team performance, a very spirited performance, some great finishing. Thomas Frank switched to back three. That seemed to really work. And my boy, Ethan Pinnock, who has already bagged himself the goal of the season, I thought put in a brilliant performance to shackle Kai Havertz. And he was one of several Brentford defenders who played an almost perfect game. And combined with their forward players, yeah, it was a thoroughly deserved win. And Chelsea didn't really seem to have too many answers for them.
I mean, we've had many Ethan Pinnock-based questions. Paul says, does Barry think any of Brentford's goals on Saturday are up there with Ethan Pinnock's efforts against Liverpool? Will, did any of Brentford's goals against Chelsea get close to rivaling Ethan Pinnock's goal of the season against Liverpool? Did any of them?
I'm trying to think now. No, I don't think so, no.
Okay.
No.
Well, obviously not. It's goal of the season. It's ridiculous to even ask the question. Look, Brentford's first win over Chelsea since 1939, which is one of those ridiculous stats because they barely played them. But, Robin, a wonderful moment for those fans who've supported Brentford all the way up the leagues. You know, when even sort of 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the idea of going to Stamford Bridge in the league and winning so emphatically would just be completely ridiculous. It sort of gives hope to all lower league fans in a way.
I think so. And it as long as your club is run the right way, they clearly have a plan and identity and they've carried it out to the letter. And it's been interesting for Brentford because they were sort of drifting a little bit and there was a few murmurings about could they get dragged into a relegation battle. And it's almost the sort of the storyline with them and Christian Eriksen, because without sort of sounding, I don't want this to sound sort of insensitive, but had that not happened to him, Brentford wouldn't have been able to sign him, obviously. He's arrived and he's given them sort of just a little bit more, just a huge boost. And also this feeling of goodwill from everyone in football, of course. And I just feel like that's seen them over the line. I mean, obviously they may have stayed up anyway, but that doesn't fit the narrative and the incoming Hollywood film, which is obviously going to happen about Christian Eriksen.
Who plays Christian Eriksen?
Very good question.
It's a good point. I can't think instantly of who looks like
Stuart Little, the mouse.
You want an animated
Christian Eriksen is the Premier League player who most resembles a mouse.
Okay.
And I don't think he's done much recently, actually, Stuart Little. So it'd be nice get some work
to get him back to get back on the just get back on the horse. Although mice don't really ride horses, do they? But you get the drift.
The Mouseketeers did.
That's a good point. Jamie says, is Ivan Toney a better shout than Dominic Calvert-Lewin, Ollie Watkins, or Patrick Bamford for the World Cup squad? Maybe even ahead of Tammy Abraham as a Harry Kane backup. I don't know what you think about that, Wilson, but he and Benwell were brilliant on Saturday, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And you know, it's entirely reasonable that Eriksen's got all the headlines, but the day that Eriksen made his comeback was also when Ivan Toney came back from injury. Yeah, the two of them being back have made a huge difference. So I think before Saturday, Brentford had only scored 10 goals in the previous 11 games, and Toney had scored 8 of them, and he'd been injured for at least half of them. So that he's massively important to them. He must be in Southgate's thinking. I'm kind of very nervous about this idea of, or very anti this idea of, oh, he deserves a call up, because I just don't think that's how you should run a national team. You know, the national team should be run like a club squad, and you should bring in players who fit the squad. It's not like a Blue Peter badge for playing well in the league. But I know Ollie Watkins played well in the two friendlies, and I know that, you know, his form recently has been a bit better. But I don't think there's a nailed-on backup to Kane. So I don't think there's plenty of time between now and November, although not many games, for Toney to make that place his own.
Robin, do you think that this is a blip for Chelsea? This is a one-off? I heard, I can't remember, some ex-players saying eventually what's happening above them with the ownership and et cetera will filter down. It's a constant debate. Oh, you cross the white line, it means nothing. But they'll obviously be talking in the dressing room. Do you see this as just a blip, or is that an impossible question to answer? We just have to wait and see.
Yeah, no, I that's a really interesting point, actually, because I felt that eventually, yes, this will catch up with them, because I'm sure it takes a lot of headspace to get to kind of really, well, even contemplate what's happening as a player. You know, they're only human. I'm sure they're thinking about their futures and what's actually going to happen, especially like players like Mason Mount, who've been there since they were very small. But in terms of actually on the pitch, I feel like they haven't been that great for quite a while now. They've kind of squeaked past Newcastle with an amazing Kai Havertz goal. They did just enough. I did their Champions League game against Lille, and, you know, they did just about enough. You know, it was fairly convincing victory in the end. But the performances, actually, I feel like they haven't been that great for a while. And also, Jonathan, I'm not sure if you might have a better memory than me.
I mean, almost certainly Jonathan has a better memory than everybody I've ever met. Yeah. So probably.
I know that, yeah, it always amuses me when I get the fiver and they call you the floating brain in a jar. But one of the goals they can see against Brentford, I think, was against Liverpool, when Jorginho made that mistake on the halfway line, completely exposed, and they just ran through and scored. They just seem like, that seems unusual to me for like Thomas Tuchel to kind of let that happen again, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think where Tuchel's slightly different to, say, Klopp, is that although he plays a high line, I think generally he's pretty good at guarding against that. Whether this game is the start of wider issues to do with the ownership and that uncertainty, filtering down, or whether it's like the game against West Brom last season when they lost 5-2 out of nowhere. That was what it sort of felt like to me, but it may be something deeper, who knows? And that game against West Brom also came before a big Champions League game where they won 2-0 away to Porto. So in a similar way, I think it clearly wasn't their strongest team, because they were partly looking ahead to the Real Madrid game. So they underestimated their opponents with a bigger game on the horizon. I think that's also possible. We'll find out how significant it is, but yeah, I think it is. Yeah, you know, if you play with that high line, you will get caught sometimes. I sort of think Tuchel generally is pretty good at guarding against that. He's slightly more conservative than Klopp, but you're right. You know, for it to happen twice in when was it New Year's Day, the Liverpool game? It was very early this year, anyway. So twice in what month are we in? April. So 3 months is a lot.
Not doing a whole lot for the you have the best memory in the world there, Wilson. Barry, where on the...
I just got cut out of the meeting there for about 3 minutes. Is Wilson giving the same answer there as he was
No.
When
no,
I
no.
left.
We've actually covered all the pod. We've done the whole pod, Barry. And reminds me to say thank you for your time, Barry. We'll be back on Wednesday. Barry, where on the Ethan Pinnock scale do you put Antonio Rudiger's goal? Because I know they lost, so you don't tend to talk about them. But that was utterly ridiculous, wasn't it?
Yeah, just a thunderbolt out of nowhere, in off the post. From a quite unexpected source, he looked as surprised as anyone when it went in. And it's one of those goals where, you know, we always find a way to criticise defenders or it's someone's fault. But it was one of several goals scored over the weekend in the Premier League where I just don't think there's much anyone could have done about it to keep it out. And, you know, a fine goal, but ultimately one that's probably worthless.
Mm. I think if you are Thomas Frank and Chelsea are resorting to Antonio Rudiger taking pot shots from 35 yards, you sort of think we'll probably be okay. Henry says, and much was made of this, if you won 4-1 at Chelsea, what song would you put on for celebration and why would you pick Dancing in the Moonlight? Apparently, I think it was Ivan Toney was in charge of the music and he chose Top Loader's Dancing in the Moonlight, which upset, obviously, music snobs. I imagine John Bruin just was absolutely livid by this, that he didn't put something on by Tom Waits or The Fall or just some other bands I haven't ever listened to but pretend I know and wear T-shirts with them to appear slightly cooler. But, you know, there was a time where I really liked Dancing in the Moonlight. Can't say I listen to it all the time now, but, you know, whatever floats your boat.
To be clear, Max, it's not Top Loader's Dancing in the Moonlight. It's someone else's Dancing in the Moonlight. Top Loader just did a very bad cover version of it. I imagine John Bruin would probably agitate that Brentford should have their points docked and Chelsea be given a 3-0 win.
Is it 12 points for going into administration and 18 points for playing Top Loader at the end of your most famous victory in the history of the club? Let's move on to the two title chases then. Liverpool beat Watford 2-0 at home. Man City won by the same scoreline at Burnley. Sort of felt, Robin, that Man City made it look incredibly easy against a Burnley side who were just, you know, it's an easy place to go at the moment, Turf Moor, and that's not what we're used to.
Well, yeah, no, it does make me laugh when every manager says it's a tough place to go, and actually it's not been very tough for quite a while. Yeah, I mean, usually Man City, it's usually 4-5-0 against Burnley, and they seem to just sort of stop. It could have been a lot more. Yeah, I just love the way De Bruyne strikes the ball for every time. It just looks so effortless, doesn't it, when he scores a goal. And yeah, I think, you know, both Man City and Liverpool, perhaps Liverpool definitely had a tougher time against Watford, but in terms of the title race, I don't think anyone really had too many doubts that both teams would win their games this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan, the Watford had those two big chances, didn't they? One at 0-0, one at 1-0, which you sort of think could have changed the game, but probably Liverpool would have still turned it on and won.
Probably, yeah. But I mean, Liverpool were a long way from their best. And again, you know, coming off an international break with a massive Champions League game, playing against a team in the bottom three, you can understand if they weren't quite at it. I mean, City were much more comfortable winners, although as they were both 2-0, City were much more comfortable winners than Liverpool on Saturday.
Joe Gomez filling it right back, Barry, was excellent, wasn't it? His delivery was Alexander-Arnold-esque.
Yeah, I said this to you yesterday on the radio. I think I've said it before on the pod that he's kind of the forgotten man of Liverpool. He's been out injured for a very long time. And in his absence, maybe we've forgotten just how good he is because he is a terrific player. But with Joel Matip and Virgil van Dijk sort of ahead of him in the pecking order, you tend to just forget that he's there because his absence isn't really noted that often. But he's a great defender. He's brilliant going forward. And the cross for Jota was absolutely, you know, pinpoint. Quite a brave header as well, I thought. But I suppose, you know, that Jota's not a big man. He's not a tall player, but he's very, very good in the air.
Yeah, I think so.
Is he? Right. So yeah. It's not particularly tall.
No, he's amazing in the air, yeah.
I wonder, is he third in the pecking order when he's fully fit and has a few games under his belt, or is he ahead of Matip in the pecking order? Because they're both fine players, and Liverpool are lucky to have all three of them, but one will invariably be kicking their heels on the bench.
I didn't hear this for myself, but somebody said, Darren Fletcher on BT said, if you close your eyes, you could think that was a Trent Alexander-Arnold cross. You sort of think, well, if you've closed your eyes, it's quite hard. It's quite hard to tell who's crossing the ball, really. But you understand the point.
Or if indeed the ball has been crossed.
Maybe it's the sound it makes when he hits it.
Yeah, possibly. As I said to you yesterday, Barry, you know, do we need to start a campaign for Joe Gomez to be put into central midfield because he's so good on the ball? Liverpool played Benfica in the Champions League on Tuesday. City play Atleti on Tuesday night. And actually, Wilson, I mean, I think Burnley... It is interesting how Burnley, and I think we've kind of thought, well, they'll get out of it because they're Burnley and they've had loads of games in hand. But their games in hand are slowly running out. They have this game on Wednesday against Everton, which is just huge, isn't it?
It is. It is massive. Because Everton are the team they're chasing. Everton were dreadful at West Ham on Sunday.
Can I just say on the Liverpool penalty... it caused a bit of controversy, didn't it? I mean, it probably was.
So good.
Yeah. I mean, it was proper, rugby tackle. But what it was really funny because they pointed out on Match of the Day 2 yesterday that Roy Hodgson was saying, oh, you know, no one noticed it. And then VAR gives it. That's basically what VAR, what VAR is there for.
Very funny. I did enjoy him saying, I didn't see anything, so therefore it shouldn't go to VAR. Yeah. Roy, you're 50 yards away, you know, and... No, I don't know how good his eyesight may be brilliant, but he's also 74, aren't you? I don't know if that's ageist.
I think owls have pretty good eyesight, don't they? And given he is true, sort of an owl in human form.
But we didn't know which way his head was facing. He could have been spinning his head. It could have been 180 degrees, obviously.
I suspect owls have nearly 360 degree vision, don't they? Isn't that why they've got such wide eyes and why they're sort of so set to the edges?
I'm not entirely sure. But I mean, it does beg the question. I'm very much looking forward to. We know who's going to play. who's going to play Roy Hodgson in his cameo in the Christian Eriksen movie? Is that owl from Bagpuss? Was there an owl in Bagpuss?
It's a woodpecker, Professor Yaffle.
A woodpecker. Okay.
Is there an owl in Harry Potter? Is there or something?
That'll do. Some literary owl can play the role of Roy Hodgson as he just turns up to wish Christian Eriksen good luck as Stuart Little runs off after scoring another goal.
I mean,
wouldn't he be swooping down to eat Christian Eriksen?
Well, we don't know how the movie ends, but hopefully at the end of the season, Roy Hodgson doesn't try and kill Christian Eriksen. That would really take a turn. I mean, Hollywood might be more interested. Anyway, that'll do for part one. David Ornstein tweeting from The Athletic that Jack Grealish is on the verge of agreeing a major sponsorship contract with Gucci. The 26-year-old Man City and England midfielder set to sign a 7-figure deal, become the ambassador for the Italian brand, thought to be unprecedented among sports people. Well, I was the face of... Kappa 0809, so not unprecedented, and then replaced by a model. A huge surprise, but it was not a 7-figure deal, unfortunately. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Old Trafford. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Emily writes, when are we going to get an actual live show? Attended all of the lockdown, post-lockdown Zoom type shows. I'm desperate for an in-person show. So hopefully when you mentioned live shows a few weeks ago back on the pod, you meant actual live shows if Max can get back to the UK. Well, good news, Emily, and hopefully thousands more of you. Because if it is just Emily who turns up, then it'll be a very intimate affair. This is the announcement, Barry, of a Football Weekly live tour this summer. On the road, in June and July. Tickets go live via mytickets.co.uk on Wednesday afternoon. And we will be playing London, Glasgow, Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds and Dublin. Barry, are you excited?
I am. I'm looking forward to getting out on the road with you, Max, when you return from Australia and having to listen to lots of banal anecdotes about your new son. And look at endless photographs of him doing things that aren't very interesting.
So that's what the live shows will be. It'll just be me and a slideshow of baby photos. Here he is looking a bit like he did yesterday. But as a dad, I think he's doing something really different. But he's just looking to the side.
Yeah, I think it's a good opportunity for us to reconnect with our listeners properly.
I think
translation,
so.
Get drunk with after shows in various venues around the country.
Absolutely. And we're hopefully going to be hawking merchandise, but in a kind of polite way. And at the same time, we have some decent outtakes from the pod, which are almost worth the admission fee alone, as well as, you know, whatever nonsense we get up to. So, yeah, we'll stick out the link and force you to buy the tickets. Let's go to Old Trafford. Manchester United 1, Leicester 1. Pavan says, did Manchester United miss Ronaldo? I mean, Wilson, Leicester were unlucky in this game, weren't they?
I mean, De Gea made a very good save. They had a goal ruled out that... I mean, I think it was a foul, but I wouldn't have been massively upset if it hadn't been given as a foul. The XG was roughly, I think it was 1.04 to 0.96. That would suggest it was a pretty even game. It felt pretty even to me. I just didn't think it was a very good game of football.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson. I mean, it's really interesting what's happening with Ralf Rangnick, and I certainly wanted him to be a success, or I thought he would be a successful appointment. But as Lars tweeted the other day, you know, they brought someone in who was good at long-term planning and good at building a club from above, not actually doing the first team business, and they made him do the first team for 6 months. You know, like it's sort of, so actually, when you stand back, because when I first saw it, I thought this is a sensible appointment. And when you actually think about it, it seems like getting the, just putting the wrong, right person in the wrong place, Robin.
That's exactly it, isn't it? Yeah. No, I was with you. I thought that was a really shrewd appointment. But yeah, it seems like they just should have had him in as a consultant immediately and not really bothered, because it sounds like he actually doesn't do a lot of coaching. In fact, he hasn't done it for a very, very long time. And clearly, I mean, yeah, against Leicester, I actually think they did probably miss Ronaldo, because they did create a lot of chances. And I think I remember Sancho scuffing one. Didn't even play with a striker to start with, did he? Played with Bruno Fernandes as the furthest forward, which, again, is very upsetting in terms of Marcus Rashford's form. It's really sad to see him at the moment. When they sacked Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, they almost kind of binned off this season, didn't they? Because they were looking for an interim manager.
But I think they did think that they would still get in the top four. I mean, they still might, I guess. But it just doesn't. It just hasn't worked. Wilson, I don't know if you thought it would work.
My concern was, what does consultant mean? I could see this working if it was, right, he's going to come in for 6 months, he's going to assess the squad from the inside, then he's going to move into an actually quite important upstairs role. And based on what he's gleaned from these 6 months of being in charge, he's going to reshape the squad and bring in a coach of his choosing. But because that was never made explicit, you know, I sort of get it from a player's point of view as well, that you've got this kind of slightly weird academic German bloke comes in, starts telling you to play in a completely different way to how you've ever played. And you're thinking, well, you've gone in June. Why would I go through this effort? And I sort of felt, because the consultant role was never sort of properly explained what it meant, that was always going to be the danger. It now just looks like, I mean, it's the lack of football expertise again at the club. And you fear that if they bring in Ten Hag, the same thing will happen. That, yes, oh, look, Ajax are doing well. Yeah, Ten Hag seems to be highly thought of. We'll bring him in. But there's no sort of understanding of what makes Ten Hag good, which is that, you know, he is a coach and he has a structure around him, and that structure helps him to be a very good coach. And it's not like bringing in Matt Busby or bringing in Alex Ferguson, where you can just appoint this messianic figure and he can do everything. You have to have a proper management structure there, and United just don't seem to have it. And I don't know what the different parts do, and there just doesn't seem to be any leadership that understands how any of that works.
What did you make of Leicester, Barry? I thought the goal was wonderful. What did you make of them overall?
I thought they were the better team, I have to say. Ian Acho's goal was good. He got the better of Alex Telles, I think it was, to convert a cross from Madison's wrong foot. I thought Madison's winner, in inverted commas, was a bit harsh to rule it out. Yes, it was a foul. Was it a clear and obvious error? I don't think so. But that's the biggest bone of contention there is around VAR. It's all subjective opinions, and my opinion doesn't matter. But
matters to me, Barry.
Oh, thank you. I often wonder. But, yeah, I thought it was a poor Manchester United performance, but it wasn't particularly surprisingly poor. They're generally quite mediocre these days, and with so much uncertainty around so many areas of the club, it's no great surprise. You know, there's uncertainty around Ralf Rangnick. There's uncertainty around a number of players as to whether they will be there next season or not. It just seems like they're kind of sleepwalking towards the end of the season, and Tottenham and Arsenal seem to have all the impetus as far as getting that fourth place, or indeed third place maybe, depending on what happens to Chelsea, is concerned.
Yeah, Spurs hammered Newcastle 5-1. They're level on points with Arsenal. They overtook them. They're in fourth. They have played two games more, though. They have to play each other. And when they got going, Robin, it took them a while. They actually blew Newcastle away, didn't they?
Oh, they were incredible. And Harry Kane's like, apart from De Bruyne, he's probably the best passer in the Premier League. It's just ridiculous. The weight, the vision, it's just incredible. And they highlighted it again on the highlights yesterday, that his sort of where he's touching the ball is everywhere. And, you know, all these people saying, why is he dropping so deep? I mean, that's why. If he's got sort of, you know, the right targets and things like that, he can find them. I just am so impressed with his all-round game, and really pleased also for Matt Doherty, because I think he was on his way out, actually, in January, and now he's got a new lease of life. And finally, Antonio Conte's preferred system seems to be bearing fruit. You know, Kulusevski and Bentancur look really good signings in terms of the way they want to play. And yeah, no, they really look like they're finally clicking.
It's not so long ago. I don't know whether it was when he was playing for England or Tottenham or both, that his dropping deep was a major point of criticism. I think certainly from me, and I don't think I was alone, but was it that his passing range wasn't as good then, or that he didn't have the runners to pick out? I don't know, but
he needs the runners, doesn't he? And that's why the England game against Switzerland, it didn't really work with Mount and Foden because he didn't have anybody running beyond him as Sterling runs beyond him. And I think possibly the wing-backs in that game were slightly more cautious than they would be if they were sort of a more settled pair of wing-backs. It only makes sense in the drop deep if he has players going beyond him to receive a pass, as Son does and as Sterling does. But that's not really an issue of them dropping deep. That's an issue of the general makeup of the team.
West Ham 2, Everton 1. You were there, Wilson. How was it?
It was very odd, to be honest. I sort of felt West Ham were playing at about 60%. And then every now and again, they forgot themselves, played properly, and just tore through Everton. And then Everton got themselves back in the game. Then give West Ham a goal with Iwobi miscontrolling that Michael Keane pass. And then Michael Keane gets sent off for a stupid, unnecessary lunge, and the game's over. And so, Lampard afterwards, I sort of semi-understood what he was saying when he sort of said, if we keep playing like that, we'll be fine. And it was just circumstances went against us. And he said, you won't have Richarlison missing two chances like that every week. You won't have an opposition player smashing a free kick in the top corner every week. You won't have a player injured in the warm-up every week. You won't have a player getting sent off every week. And you said, but you do have a player sent off every week. And you are in charge of a team that makes silly mistakes every week. That's the level of team you've got. And you can't complain that football keeps happening to you, because that is literally what being a football manager is. I don't know. I mean, at least he wasn't blaming his players. He's gone from blaming his players to blaming circumstances. But I'd quite like to hear sort of a slightly more positive, this is what I'm going to do to put this right. I mean, he did, in his list of things that went right, he did have the game plan as second, which obviously is a bit he runs. So, he's obviously fine with the job he's doing himself. But, that's five away games now, scored two goals, conceded 16, no points. They do have five games of a 10 remaining at home. But I think it's very dependent on them getting results in those home games. That Burnley match midweek is obviously huge, because if Burnley win that, they're suddenly only a point behind, having played the same number of games. So then there's real pressure. And this is not an Everton side that seems to deal particularly well with pressure.
Yeah, I wonder, Barry, if it makes a difference that most of these Everton players aren't really used to being in a relegation scrap, and the Burnley players are, that's what they do. And I don't know, it sort of feels like that shouldn't affect you because, you know, playing a football match is still just playing a football match. But you wonder if you don't know how to navigate those choppy waters, it'll affect you. Because it just feels unthinkable that Everton will go down, even though they patently could go down.
They patently could go down. And if they do, it could be a while before they come back up because the ramifications of being relegated for Everton, I think, and Burnley in particular, above all other teams who are sort of in the mix, are financially catastrophic, relegation would be, you know. Everton's wages are 95% of the turnover. They no longer have the financial benevolence of Alisher Usmanov to rely on. So them going down would be a massive, big deal. And the other part of your question about, you know, if they're unused to fighting relegation, I definitely think that's a factor because you get the fear, don't you? And you're terrified of being the guy who makes a mistake. But for all their grisliness and battle hardiness, Burnley showed very little fight against City in a game I suppose most of their players didn't expect to get anything out of. But you want to at least see them put up some sort of fight, and they didn't.
Let's go to Ellen Road. Leeds 1, Southampton 1. Only David Beckham, Robin, has scored more direct free kicks in Premier League history when football began than James Ward-Prowse. It's sort of ludicrous every time he takes one and it goes in the top corner.
Love watching him take a free kick. The technique is just beautiful. It kind of, you know, that sort of head down, it almost kind of crumples his body over and you just, yeah, it's just incredible. The consistency, the accuracy. But yeah, then as we've already seen it when you asked any questions on Twitter, we are going to get this tedious debate about why or why not he should be in the England team. Because also, I think actually because he's so good at free kicks, perhaps his other contributions aren't seen as much. Because he's a pretty decent Premier League midfielder as well. But
how good? I mean, you've probably seen more of him than me. How good is he compared to, you know, what, Rice, Phillips, Bellingham, Henderson?
Well, it's what Jonathan said earlier. It's about the system that Gareth Southgate wants to play, and perhaps he's not quite as, I don't want to say as good, but perhaps he doesn't have those sort of qualities that a Rice, a Phillips has. But he can certainly contribute. And the thing is with him, he's got incredible athleticism, fitness. He basically never misses a game, which I think can't be sniffed at as well. But, you know, also he can pass a ball. You know, he can play football as well as do these amazing free kicks.
He is a footballer. That's the insight that people come to Football Weekly for from him.
I think Kyle Walker-Peters' role in that goal has been completely overshadowed by the brilliance of the free kick because he sort of turned into John Barnes against Brazil, leaving this trail of bodies trailing in his wake before, I think, Luke Ayling took him down to give away the free kick. And it was like, where the hell has that come from? this long dribble upfield, beating man after man after man.
Jody says, on the subject of pub graffiti, I snapped this in the peerless Euston Tap in 2018. Seems somewhat outdated these days and is graffiti that just says in capital letters, James Ward-Prowse takes middling free kicks at best, to which someone beneath has written, everyone's a critic. Love the pod. It'd benefit from a little more focus on Partick Thistle. But other than that, keep up the good work. On the subject of Leeds, look, Jesse March has done well, hasn't he? And another good point for them. I can't remember which one of you pointed this out in the WhatsApp group. Matthias Click replying to people on Twitter. Oliver Wicks got in touch with us, actually, to say, not a question, more a plea for more of this instead of the comms team apology. At Loina23 tweeted to Matthias Click, stop giving the ball away. Stop giving the fucking ball away, for fuck's sake, and stupid free kicks around the box. It's kids' stuff, for fuck's sake. To which Matthias Click replied, fuck off, full stop, Bob. Full stop. Good for you, Matthias. Russell says, would Barry be able to walk a mile in Calvin Phillips' shoes?
I would, but I suspect if I walked through Brixton in Calvin Phillips' shoes, I would be the subject of much ridicule and possibly physical assault. They're quite perplexing as footwear goes. I'm really not sure if he was wearing them because he lost a bet, if it was a dare, or they're fashionable. I just don't know, because I'm very unfashionable and not on trend with what the young people are wearing these days.
I mean, they were either sort of wontons, croissants, big blocks of cheese, that kind of thing. I mean, look, whatever makes you happy, I guess. But I mean,
well, I just wonder if there's a possibility he hadn't taken them out of the bag, and was just sort of like didn't want to. Was it? I don't know if it was raining. He just didn't want to get them dirty.
But you don't get two shoes in two separate bags, two identical bags, do you?
Personally, no. But then I don't spend a lot of money on shoes. And like, yeah, the time when I first got shoes in a nice little cloth bag, I sort of go, oh, Christ, I've really made it now. But maybe if you're footballer level, you get two bags, one for each shoe.
So like the rest of us would just be stood in a shoebox and sort of shuffling down the street. Anyway, at Wolves 2, Aston Villa 1, Craig says, can we have a little appreciation for João Moutinho, 35, won his 144th Portugal cap after starting both playoff games, dominated the midfield in Wolves' win over Villa, simply one of the best ever. And as I said to Barry, he won the Battle of the Utinios, didn't he, yesterday, which is a battle that I've been itching to see for a long, long time. Robin, he's a brilliant player, and you know, I think we take João Moutinho for granted.
Yeah, just another one of those sort of evergreen midfielders. Like, everyone keeps saying Modric is going to, you know, because of his age, he's going to start fading away, but he just doesn't. Yeah, no, he's been so impressive, and he, again, just fits into that Wolves system effortlessly. Like, you know, again, it's the sort of polar opposite to Manchester United almost. And you got Brentford, you got Wolves. They've got a clear vision of what they want from their club, and they just execute it.
Him and Neves are like a comfortable pair of bags you'd put over a comfortable pair of shoes before leaving the house. Villa lost three in a row, Barry. Steven Gerrard said after the game, the players in the building have to help me fix it now. If not, we'll get players in who will help me fix it. It's tough talk.
Yeah, but they're a bit up and down, a bit Southampton-y, I suppose. I think they should be more consistent. Villa, look, they're fine. They're going to finish mid-table and we'll see how they get on next season. But they were so bad in the first half of that game. And that seems to be a recurring theme. And then Gerrard gets stuck into them at half-time and they up their game in the second half. This certainly isn't the first time this has happened to them since he took over. And yeah, I think he needs to get them motoring from the start rather than the 46th minute.
Brighton 0, Norwich 0. And that'll do for part two. Part three. Part three will do the World Cup draw. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jack says, whose stock has shot up more in the past week? Barry's for calling the Brentford-Chelsea upset, or Jermaine Genius's agent for landing him that World Cup draw gig? Joachim, have you ever watched anything as fascinating as Jermaine Genius barking orders at Cafu, JJ Okocha and Lota Mateus? So yeah, the World Cup draw has been done. Group A, Qatar, Ecuador, Senegal, Netherlands. Group B, England, Iran, USA, and then Wales, Scotland or Ukraine. Group C, Argentina, Saudi Arabia, Mexico and Poland. Group D, France, Denmark, Tunisia, and then one of the United Arab Emirates, Peru or Australia. Group E, Spain, Germany, Japan, and one of Costa Rica and New Zealand. Group F, Belgium, Canada, Morocco, Croatia. Group G, Brazil, Serbia, Switzerland, Cameroon. And Group H, Portugal, Ghana, Uruguay and South Korea. Let's begin, Barry, with your thoughts on England's group. Because I've seen you've been tweeting quite joyously about it.
I originally thought it was a very easy group. I still do think it's an easy group. And I don't buy this thing that collectively the FIFA rankings mean it's the hardest group. But I suppose when you look at it, the expectation is that whatever group England were going to be in, they would be expected to come out of it and come out of it quite easily. That obviously doesn't always happen. And I have a funny feeling they might really mess this World Cup up, but we'll see. I could be absolutely deluded, and that may just be wishful thinking, but I think they're due a catastrophe in a major competition. But if they come out of the group on top, their path to the final is unlikely to be... not only will it not be easy, it'll be extremely difficult. And if they do go on to win this World Cup, it certainly won't be the... or is very unlikely to be the ridiculously easy path they had to the semi-final last time. A semi-final, I continue to insist, they should have won. Whether the Croatians were supposed to be tired or not, they should have won that semi-final. They should have won the Euros. And I'm sure they'll find some new and interesting way to mess this tournament up as well.
I don't think it's an easy group. It's actually, yeah, it has got very... it's got that vibes of... oh, actually, last time played USA. And actually, yeah, my first thought was for poor Rob Green, who is going to be asked about that incident over and over again between now and the World Cup. And I think he'll probably be working for Five Live. And it's, yeah, it's going to bring back terrible memories from which he's going to be asked about.
He did tweet, didn't he? He did tweet those, just the eyes looking to the side, which I thought was very... just get in there early. He's very good, Rob Green, actually. Now I really like him as a pundit.
He's excellent. Also, on Jermaine Genus, I think it's very harsh, because anyone who can present the one show, which, as we know, has the most ridiculously sharp gear changes, you know, he's earned that. I really do think that.
I mean, of course, the greatest one show moment is Mel Brooks, which I don't know if you've seen it. They just...
crazy show this is.
This show is nuts.
This show is nuts.
If you're like a fan in Rio or Buenos Aires, or I mean literally anywhere apart from England, you must be going, who's this bloke? Why is he on there?
Former Spurs, Newcastle legend.
I mean, the serious point is, I guess, is whether, you know, you should sort of judge people for taking FIFA's money in Qatar on the sort of serious...
Well, I know you pulled out the running quite early because of that, and I admire you for it.
Absolutely. I don't think I'm going to get offered that gig, and I think I'd probably have to turn it down, wouldn't I? I'm sure Barry will try and get me that, like the £1 million gambling deal he's trying to get me that I can't then take.
It'd be Philippe O'Brien,
yes,
be on your shoulder.
No, I want Philippe to do the draw. That would be so good. Philippe hugging Infantino, like, that's so glorious to see. Lots of Americans getting in touch. Emmett saying, I'm so happy that my beloved Yanks are in a group with England, likely either Wales or Scotland, so you'll be forced to hold your noses and give us pod time for the next 6 months. Better start reading up on the great USMNT striker debate now. Who do the pod think Greg Berhalter, aka Triple G, should pick out first? Out of Pepe riding the bench at Augsburg, Sargent playing on the wing at Norwich, or Pifok tearing it up at Young Boys and missing sitters in CONCACAF? Can't wait to hear 20 minutes of this in the next pod. Many apologies for any poor pronunciations there. Steve says, if USA beat England at the World Cup, can we get a USA tour for Football Weekly Live? That is the plan for 2023. At least it's my plan. No one has gone for it. Yeah, but anything so I can say hello, New York. Alex says, hi, Football Weekly gang. God almighty, my mum is English. My dad's Iranian. I'm married to an American. And I became a US citizen in 2020. I was really hoping to finally get an Iran-England match, but this is too much. I thought you'd appreciate that Iranian Twitter users are already at their best. One user posted, forget the group of death. This is the group of death too. Oh, well, roll on November, and do let my fellow listeners know that I intend to procure a third and third and third scarf for the occasion. It's coming home. Just took on a whole new meaning in this house. Cheers, Alex. What about the rest of the draw, Wilson? Spain-Germany sort of looks like a fun game. Uruguay-Ghana after, of course, what Luis Suarez did in 2010. What do you make of the draw itself?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the question I would ask to people who sort of say, oh, yeah, England's group's really easy. Well, look at the other seed. You know, putting in place of any other seed, which of those other groups is clearly harder? And yeah, you know, basically Germany is the one you want to avoid. Japan's record at World Cups is pretty poor. You sort of think they've got to kick on eventually. So yeah, Spain Germany is clearly the biggest game of the first round. I guess the other pot two team who you probably wanted to avoid was the Netherlands. Louis van Gaal revealed last night he's got prostate cancer and has had 25 treatments for it, and you know, it's all this documentary about him has come out, sort of details that. So I mean, yeah, hopefully he's okay for the World Cup, and he's obviously had a major impact on dragging the Netherlands through qualifying, because they were really wobbling before he took over. But that, I think, is a really interesting group with Qatar as hosts. Don't quite know how good they're going to be, but they did win the Asian Cup in 2019. They're obviously not a useless side. Senegal, the African champions, I think still haven't quite hit their peak. I think they probably should be slightly better going forward than they have been, either the Cup of Nations or those two playoffs against Egypt. So that, I think, is a tough group. And then, that Ghana, Uruguay, it's group H, isn't it? Ghana, Uruguay, Portugal and South Korea. I think that's a really difficult group. I think they're therefore not brilliant, but decent sides. I mean, Ghana had a terrible Cup of Nations and they only got through the playoff on away goals. But the game in Abuja, very, very difficult conditions. I thought they showed a lot of maturity. That Otto Addo has taken over as an interim coach under Chris Heaton as technical director or director of football or whatever his title is. And although they drew those two games against Nigeria, I thought you could sort of see signs of a proper structure there. So I think that group, I think group A is probably the hardest to call. Group A, I think, looks interesting as well.
Is Asamoah Gyan still going somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be in favour of bringing back an elderly striker for every team. So I'd have Josie Altidore there for the US, Dixie Dean for England.
You went Dean. I thought you might go Mark Hatley, but fair enough, Dean.
I was a big fan of Mark Hatley. I thought Mark Hatley should have got more of a crack.
Who are you bringing for France? Papin?
Yeah, probably. Or Just Fontaine.
Just Fontaine. Butragueño. Hugo Sanchez has got to come in, of course, hasn't he?
God, the USA are really getting the shitty end of that stick, aren't they? Josie Altidore.
Anyway, yes, well, look, we'll obviously cover the World Cup. Somebody yelled at me for saying that I asked the question, how should we cover this with, the football and Qatar? And I wasn't really sure. And someone told me that, I should do my job. And hopefully I know how to do my job by the time we get to the World Cup. It seems a fair question to be not completely sure.
Well, but my piece on Saturday, I ended up just sort of saying that this is going to be a tournament of awful gear changes. Because, I sort of started off sort of three paragraphs on England's group and then sort of had
which
to
is,
stop myself.
Which is why Jermaine Dean is hosting the draw is perfect, because he'd come straight from the one show. So exactly know how to do those gear changes.
I mean, the stadium where England start, the Al Khalifa Stadium, is where Zach Cox, an English worker, died in 2017 falling 130 feet. Now, he's one of only three deaths that the Qataris have accepted were work-related on World Cup projects. But, Amnesty suggests that figure is much higher. The Guardian had a piece last year saying 6,500 migrant workers from South Asia have died in Qatar on infrastructure projects in the last decade. So, we actually getting to the truth of that is extremely difficult. But everywhere you go in Qatar, you're going to have that issue of, sitting in a press box. And you know that the conditions of the labourers who built that press box worked in were appalling. And that's going to be... I still think our job is to go and to report that and to cover that. But it's going to be a very uncomfortable experience, I think.
But the World Cup boss man in Qatar, Hassan Al-Tawadi, he spent the days up to and including the draw telling everyone they need to educate themselves. And, there's a Norwegian camera crew who tried to educate us and they got arrested. There's a construction worker who tried to educate us. He got thrown in solitary confinement and then slung out of the country.
Well, no, he was allowed to leave the country having paid a fine for spreading fake news. So it's even worse than being slung out. Malcolm Bidali, Kenyan, yeah.
Abdullah Ibbas is in jail for trying to educate us. Anytime we try to educate... the Norwegian president, Federation president, Lisa Klaveness, she tried to educate us and was told to sit down and shut up. And anytime we try to educate anyone, we get called hypocrites and we... have to read out a very long, boring rebuttal from the Qatari World Cup organisers, who are incredibly litigious.
Ahem, and here we go.
I'm all for educating people, as Hassan Al-Tawadi says we should, but anyone who does try to educate anyone gets, at best, forced to read out a stupid statement, which I presume you'll be reading any second now, and at worst, gets thrown in jail. So, you know, it's tough.
Just because I want to, I'm going to read these out. The Supreme Committee organising the World Cup in Qatar said in a statement that its commitment to the health, safety and dignity of all workers employed on our projects has remained steadfast and unwavering. Our commitment to workers' welfare has resulted in significant improvements in accommodation standards, health and safety regulations, grievance mechanisms, healthcare provision and reimbursements of illegal recruitment fees to workers, the statement read. On a slightly different note, this question from Samuel says, what's the best winter drink to throw in the air when England score during the December dates of the World Cup? Baileys? Mulled wine? Just imagine Croydon Box Park covered in Baileys.
Eggnog.
Absolutely, really sticky day that would be, wouldn't it? Cardinal Archbishop of Lima writes, is Ange Postecoglou the most beautiful man ever? And why is the answer yes? Massive win, Barry, for Celtic in the Old Firm.
Yeah, they went behind very early to an Aaron Ramsey goal. There was some talk of whether or not Ramsey would start. Start he did, and started in fine style, putting Rangers ahead at Ibrox. But Celtic equalised soon after, went ahead, and then their defensive performance was outstanding. They've played a lot better this season, but it was a very obdurate display. They reduced Rangers to slinging crosses into the box, and they had no one to get on the end of them. Well-deserved win for Celtic. Alfredo Morales was missing for Rangers with a thigh injury, but he's never really performed against Celtic anyway, so it's difficult to know if he would have made much of a difference. But the ball is very much in Celtic's court now. They're 6 points ahead, more or less seven, because their goal difference is so good, with one Old Firm derby to come. So of course we have to report the shenanigans some Rangers fans threw, broken glass in the penalty area. Joe Hart was in the second half and hit a member of Celtic's backroom staff with a bottle. He had to get stitches, and apparently the night before the game some Celtic fans were arrested for trying to jam up the turnstiles at Ibrox with expanding foam, which is a guerrilla tactic I was unfamiliar with.
So what, the foam comes in small and then it gets bigger? And what is it? Does it solidify the foam, or is it just like you'd be walking through a foam party?
No, you squeeze it into a, like I say, I have it in my kitchen to keep mice out, to keep Christian Eriksen out of my house.
Right.
You get steel wool, jam it in any little hole you find, and then cover it in expanding foam, and the foam expands and turns rock solid. And
right,
then
there we go.
Christian can't gnaw through it because the steel wool hurts his teeth.
Right. Just so you know, Ewan Murray is at Augusta at the moment. We'll get him on when he's back on his footballing duties.
But while we're in Fitbar Corner, congratulations to Partick on ending their run of four successive defeats with a 0-0 draw against Arbroath at the weekend.
Absolutely right. We all echo those sentiments.
So they remain fourth in the championship, marvelous. One of the playoff spots.
Fraser says, did Barry chuckle at Barry Chuckle? This is with reference to the Papa John's final, where Barry Chuckle and Rotherham fan and Tim Vine.
Oh, Paul Chuckle. Barry, sadly, has shuffled off this mortal coil. And Rotherham fans famously marked his passing by doing a call and response to me, to you, to me, to you, from one stand to the other of whatever ground it is Rotherham playing at. I've forgotten, I'm afraid.
New York.
Is it the New York Stadium now? Robert?
I think it's the New York Stadium now.
It is the New York
Stadium. Oh, so you could go there and say hello, New York.
Yeah, we could if we don't do a US tour. Anyway, it was Paul Chuckle, my apologies, and Tim Vine, Sutton supporting comedian, who put the ball on a plinth, both in helmets. It was all very funny. And then Rotherham went and won the Papa John's. Last minute equaliser, scored two an extra time. It was a really good game. So well done to Rotherham on that.
And you retweeted Tim Vine's official
song,
song, didn't
you? Get out your tambourine.
I wish I hadn't listened to it, Max.
Get stuck.
It's very catchy.
He's so brilliant, Tim Vine. Brendan says, greeting, folks. It appears that Jordan Jarrett Bryan addressed his smoke alarm's maddeningly 40-second interval beeps via Twitter. However, I'm curious how none of the panel noticed nor pointed out the beeping. Did you have a hard end time and had to power through the disturbance in lieu of pausing to address the problem? Or supporting England thickened your skins to endure anything? I'll happily donate more to The Guardian if that helps Jordan get new batteries. Jokes aside, thanks for the great pod. Almost always brings me joy. Countless people pointed this out on social media. I don't know why none of us could
hear. I didn't hear a thing. I was baffled by this.
Smoke alarm was beeping every 40 seconds for the entire pod. Jordan's smoke alarm was faulty, which is risky given how hot his takes can be, says producer Joel. Well, they got to real extreme levels last one when I think he said that both Brentford and Everton would get relegated. And I can't remember, there was something else that was, a very hot, in inverted commas, i.e. ridiculous. But, you know, we love him all the same. And I believe he's got it fixed. And do check your smoke alarms and get them fixed. Kieran says, hi, team. On the topic of merchandise being rolled out, I wanted to show you all the best Kris Kringle present received. See attached. My mate Stephen had a Football Weekly, a contraband Football Weekly mug made of me staring at you, Barry. We'd like to request all proceeds go to Barry's pocket. Obviously, we're going to sue you, a bit like, you know, when a big football team sues some like tiny restaurant with a pun in it or something. But look, it's proof that people want it. Matt says this may be a narrow US interest merchandise request. I'd like to buy anything bearing Barry's Woodland Timberlakers misremembering of MLS team names. Anyway, keep those ideas coming in. footballweekly@theguardian.com, and that'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Bulls.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
Champions League returns, so we'll be back on Wednesday. Our producer is Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sars.
This is The Guardian.